Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. My guest today is Eamon Butler. Butler is a British economist as well as the co-founder and director of the Adam Smith Institute in the UK. His books include Hayek, His Contribution to the Economic and Political Thought of Our Time, Milton Friedman, A Guide to His Economic Thought, and Ludwig von Mises' Primer. So a man after his own hearts, or our own hearts, rather, the ladies and gentlemen, listeners. And so that was kind of just what I pulled off of like your Wikipedia. Is there anything else biographically that's worth noting?
Goodness me. Well, only to say that I'm working on a cartoon version of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. So condensing 800 odd pages into a set of cartoons. So that's going quite well.
That's awesome.
And it's rather amusing.
Yeah. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit more at the end as we're talking about the work of the Adam Smith Institute. So what do you do at the Adam Smith Institute?
Well, we're a think tank. We exist to put ideas into public policy debate. And they're the ideas of competition and markets and lower taxes and less government and free trade and all of these good things. So we do that through publications and through events and a lot of work with young people going out to schools, making films and producing books and lots of other things like that.
So now, is there a difference between like a think tank and like an educational institution? Because I sort of feel like at LCI, we're kind of like an information clearinghouse in a way, but we don't like lobby government or anything like that. Sometimes I think of a think tank as doing like writing policy papers and things like that. Is that part of what Adam Smith Institute does also?
Yes, but we keep a distance from politicians. You don't want to get too close to them. And so, you know, we're looking at sensible policy initiatives rather than saying, well, you should have this law, not that law. So, you know, we're looking to do things like open up the planning controls in the UK, which are extremely restrictive and which have stopped people building houses. And so house prices have gone up and young people can't afford houses and they have to live miles away from their work and so on and so on. So, you know, we're saying simply that this ought to be opened up and here's a few interesting ways you might do it, rather than to say, let's have a law saying or a new regulation on house building.
Gotcha. Yeah, when you said you don't want to get too close to the politicians, I almost made a joke that you don't want to get the sulfur on your clothes. But
something like this. Oh, that's a good one. I might start using that.
For those who maybe don't know or just need a little bit of a refresher, because we're talking about 250 years ago now, who was Adam Smith?
Well, he was a Scottish philosopher, lived between 1723 and 1790. He was a key figure in what's called the Scottish Enlightenment, a great intellectual awakening in Scotland in the 18th century. And he's the author of a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. He was a moral philosopher. But he's also the author of An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. In other words, he's also an economist. And he's widely regarded as being the father of modern economics. And that book basically set the foundation for all the economic thought which has followed it.
Well, and before we talk about Wealth of Nations, which is 250th anniversary of that book this year, as well as the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and we'll talk about those two documents and their influence. So you mentioned the theory of moral sentiments. That's kind of Smith's other great work. I'm sure, right? But at least that those are the ones people think of him for. And so what are we seeing in the theory of moral sentiments? And is that sort of foundational in some sense for what he's going to write in the Wealth of Nations, or is that just a completely different topic?
I think it informs the Wealth of Nations because it's all about honesty and justice and trust and virtue and things like that. And he's in the Wealth of Nations, he says that you can't have a successful economy unless you're aware of all of those things. He was really struggling, like all the philosophers of the time, to work out what is it that makes human action good or bad. And you might not necessarily like his answer. You know, some people said that, well, it's God's will, you know, to act in a certain way. Others said, well, we don't know what God actually intends, so perhaps we'd better just ask the clerics, and you know, their opinion would be what it is. Other people said, well, we've got a kind of moral sense. It's like smell or taste. We just know we can taste it or smell it, kind of thing. And Smith said, no, it's none of those things. Basically, we are social creatures, and we like to get on with our other social creatures, our other human beings. And so we do things which they tend to like, and we don't do things that they don't like. And if they criticize us, then we change our ways. And if they praise us, then we do more. And he's saying that because of that, because we've got that sympathy, that empathy with other human beings, that we, without really intending to, act in a way which is beneficial to the whole society. And of course, he says exactly the same thing in The Wealth of Nations, that with a famous invisible hand example, that we all are self-interested in the marketplace, but at the same time, because we're self-interested, we have to serve other people. And that's how we get our money, by serving other people and giving them goods and services that they want. And then that produces an overall wonderful social harmony. So the two books are really quite well related, I think. A lot of people don't understand that, but they are.
Well, and just not to take us too far afield, but you know, Smith is sort of thought of, as you said, in that Enlightenment tradition, which he's proposing a different theory of morality than what some would consider a Christian or divine theory or whatever. Yeah. And I would say that part of that maybe depends upon kind of your flavor of Christianity or your philosophy that you approach it.
Because
for some, if, you know, the divine command theory means essentially that, you know, God can arbitrarily say that, you know, murdering people is fine and that's okay now. Whereas others would sort of say that, well, maybe what we sort of see in natural law that's sort of baked into our relationships is a pointer to a higher law. And so there's not inherently a conflict there, at least. And I think Smith, despite not being super dogmatic in his, you know, theological convictions, I think he did sort of some positive and warm feelings about Christianity through his life, though maybe not necessarily a Christian.
He was a regular churchgoer. Mm-hmm. The church was, you know, just almost next door to his house in Edinburgh, and he went every day. He was well known for it. I think you would really describe him, I suppose, as a deist. I think that he thought that there is some force out there which is making us act for good, but he couldn't quite understand what it was. He didn't have the theory of evolution. That came 100 years later to explain, you know, why societies might develop in this way. He was, I think, influenced by David Hume, who was a great skeptic, as he would call it, but you and I would call him an atheist. So that to some extent shaped his thinking, but he could never dissociate himself from the idea that there was a good and powerful deity of some sort, which had our good on side, really.
Right. Okay. Well, so we talked a little about Wealth of Nations. Oh, we talked a little about theory of moral sentiments. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about Wealth of Nations, or an inquiry into the nature and causes of the Wealth of Nations. I think in a lot of cases, there's these books have very long titles that we've shortened over the years.
Yes, Smith called it My Inquiry. Simple as that. But we call it The Wealth of Nations. Yeah.
Well, so what were its like key insights? What made it unique at the time that it was published? Because he was saying some things that weren't necessarily being said at the time, and it shaped the course of that discipline of economics. So what was he saying that was unique?
Well, you know, The Wealth of Nations was a product of the Enlightenment, which focused on reason, natural liberty, progress, and ethics. So it's very much rooted in that. And that also shaped his economics. The key ideas in the Wealth of Nations, firstly, specialization as being what he called the division of labor. Specialization is the engine of productivity. And he has a famous example right at the beginning of the book of a pin factory. And he says, if you or I tried to make a pin, you know, we could probably make one or two pins a day, And we couldn't even do that if we had to mine the metal to make the pins off. So we'd be lost. But there you are. You've got a factory of, I think it's 18 people. And, they have a roll of wire, and one draws out the wire, and another cuts the wire, and another points the wire, and another makes the head, and another attaches the head, and then somebody else polishes it and whitens it, and then they put it in somebody else puts it in a box and wraps it and so on. And these things, because they can all do this, they can have specialist equipment to do this, and because they get incredibly skilled at doing it, then they can produce, those 18 people can produce 48,000 pins a day, he says. And so that's the, a thousandfold increase in productivity just by specialization. And he says that that's really the driver. And we see it today, of course, in everything, every industry and so on, specializes. And even within a business, there are people who specialize. So that's the first thing, the power of specialization. Secondly, and again, this is quite revolutionary at the time, he says that the wealth of a nation isn't the amount of money that it hoards and gets into its bank vaults. It's the productive capacity of the nation. It's what we would call GDP, gross domestic product. That is what is the measure of whether a country is rich or poor. Can it produce the things that it needs? Or can it produce the wealth that it needs to buy the things that it needs, rather than just how much it can take off other people? So that's the other thing. The invisible hand I've already mentioned, where he says that under the right conditions of justice and honesty and so on, that individual self-action produces a beneficial social outcome, and that it's not from the benevolence of the brewer or the baker, he says, that we get our dinner. It's because of their own self-interest. They're after their own self-interest, and we're after ours. But in that process, we have a very active economy that benefits all of us. So benefits of free trade, again, the Wealth of Nations is very much a polemic against trade restrictions and tariffs and subsidies and monopolies and government intervention and things like that. And he proposes limited government, because he thinks that large governments get corrupted because they become a magnet, people who want to get money out of them and people who want to get regulations in their favor so they don't have to face competition from others. So all of these things and more are in the book. And it was really, I suppose, the most important thing about it is that other people had thought about different bits of economics before, but Smith takes all these ideas and he takes thousands and thousands of observations from around the planet and he weaves them into a comprehensive treatise on political economy, a comprehensive economic theory. And that was new. And that, as I say, laid the foundation for all economics that follows.
Well, and you kind of hinted at this already, but it seems that a lot of populists, I was going to say leftists, but at this point, people on the right make this assumption as well. They'll confuse capitalism with cronyism or mercantilism or even slavery. I mean, that's kind of the argument of the new history of capitalism. And essentially, they say they sort of see capitalism as any attempt to make a profit. And that's their definition of capitalism. But Smith actually saw free markets as the answer to those kinds of problems, to cronyism, to mercantilism, to slavery. And so what was his argument there? And why do we still seem unable to learn from it after all these years?
Well, he thinks that cronyism and what he called mercantilism, in other words, focusing on businesses and helping them at the expense of ordinary people, cronyism and mercantilism thrive on government privileges, monopoly, and government money. And that kills competition. Part of the reason why business people go up to Washington in your case and Westminster in mine to try to get regulations out of the government or get them to change regulations or to get subsidies out of them is because it enriches those few producers but it enriches them at the expense of everybody else, including all of the taxpayers, obviously. And Smith states this in the Wealth of Nations, and he says that competition and free markets, open markets, where people come in with new ideas, innovations, that improves the goods and services that are on offer, makes them better, makes them cheaper. You know, so what's not to like? On slavery, he was very interesting because certainly in the Theory of Moral Sentiments, his earlier book, he was very morally opposed to slavery and indeed colonialism. And in The Wealth of Nations, you know, his audience, if you like, is a different audience, right? They're interested in money, right? They're interested in business and cash and growth and all of that kind of stuff. And his argument there is slightly different, which is that actually, slavery is not just only immoral, but slaves don't have an interest in what they're forced to produce. So, you know, their only interest is in avoiding as much work as possible, right? And you're not going to have an efficient economy if people are avoiding work, if people have no investment in what it is that they're producing. So he said that slavery actually cost the colonial powers money, and it didn't do much good for the Americans either. True wealth was really only came from voluntary exchange and open competition. You know, today we see concentrated interests lobbying for special favors, what we call rent seeking, getting an easy life out of the economy without any competition. And we see politicians winning votes by saying, oh yes, we'll fix this and we'll support our own domestic industries and never mind anybody else. So, you know, you see these things popping up again today, but Adam Smith has given us comprehensive answers against all of those things.
Well, and maybe to put a finer point on the slavery discussion, you know, Thomas Carlyle famously called economics the dismal science. And you often hear that quote, but you never really hear much of the context. So, you know, what was his critique and how did it land on the free market views of Smith and you know, John Stuart Mill, for example?
Well, yes, I don't find Thomas Carlyle a terribly agreeable person, actually. It was in an 1849 essay that he contrasted economics, what he called the dismal science, with poetry, which he called the gay science. And he thought that economics was dismal because it focused on supply and demand. And of course, the Malthusian ideas were very strong then, which is that the population is increasing faster than our ability to feed it. And so we're all going to have starvation and so on, unless we, you know, cull the population and so on and so on. So he thought that was kind of dismal. He also was very much an authoritarian. He wanted hierarchy and compulsion to manage societies and indeed to manage what he called were inferior races and inferior social groups, workers and so on. He thought they had to be managed by people who knew better. So he scorned Adam Smith's faith in individuals and all of the economists who were following Smith, of course, they all believed in markets. They had a faith in markets. And Carlyle thought that that'll just lead to chaos and then to poverty. So he saw Smith's idea of natural liberty, as Smith called it, socially destructive. And he preferred a sort of romantic authoritarian over dreary, dismal markets. He was wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me how that point of view ends up in the South, Southern America during kind of leading up to the Civil War. And they have a similar distaste for these free market ideas because they see it as interfering with their kind of romantic, bucolic, you know, view of agriculture in the South and of this benevolent ownership of blacks by whites. And anyway. So you mentioned the invisible hand idea, and you know, Smith talks about that, this idea that the market is sort of doing all these things because of everybody without it being managed by one person. And so it's almost like a hand is arranging the economy so that everybody gets what they need just because all these individuals are making self-interested decisions, right? And so Smith contrasts that invisible hand of the market with what he calls the man of system, the person who tries to centrally manage the economy. And, you know, left-wing Christians even have argued that the invisible hand idea is like sort of idolatrous, that it's like, you know, the market is kind of a god. But they'll sort of also say, well, you know, we need a more managed economy where an expert class can make sure everything's distributed fairly, right? And so I see a sort of a contradiction there, but what do you think someone who makes that kind of argument is missing when they see, when they sort of poo-poo the invisible hand, but they want the man of system to, you know, carefully dole out everything to the people who need it?
It's not an easy argument to understand. You know, Smith makes it in The Invisible Hand, and then others like Hayek, for example, F.A. Hayek, the Nobel economist, takes it up and explains how this works. What Smith is saying is that there isn't an obvious relationship between individual actions and social outcomes. You might think, well, you could only get a good social outcome if we were all benevolent and fair-minded, and you know, and we tried to help others, and we were altruistic, and we didn't think of ourselves at all. And Smith says, no, you know, we all have self-interest. If we didn't have self-interest, we'd be dead, right? Because we wouldn't look after ourselves. We wouldn't eat and drink and do all the other things that we need to do to stay alive. So yes, there is self-interest. And if you harness that, you actually get a positive social outcome. And he says that's what the market does. And the market has rules. It has rules of contract and enforcing contracts and justice if contracts are broken and so on. So, and it encourages virtues of trust, for example. You know, market economies are incredibly trusting societies. Centralized economies are exactly the opposite. So, you know, it's the invisible hand is a description of how you can get coordination between millions of people, indeed billions of people these days on the planet, without having to have a central direction. It just emerges naturally and it works. And because it works, we do more of it and then it works even better. So that's he contrasted with his so-called man of system, who he says treats people like the pieces on a chessboard and thinks you can move them around and make something that's, you know, better society by positioning them in certain ways. But that forgets, he says, that all of those pieces on the chessboard, all of those human beings, have got their own motivations. They've got their own ideas of what a good society should be like. They've got their own ideas of what good individual action is like. So you immediately come up against that. And then, of course, you're ignoring the complexity of individuals. This central planning ignores complexity. It ignores local knowledge. And planners put far too much faith in their own reason. It's hubris. And so, you know, Smith, you know, I think people miss the fact that Smith says that a foundation of justice is absolutely essential in this. You know, if you don't have any rules, if big businesses can go up to governments and get rules made in their favor, then it's not going to work. You know, cronyism will not work. Mercantilism will not work. But a commercial society that's aligned with providential human nature, that will work. And the only alternative is elite control, and that means coercion and force.
Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty Network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click get started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's, I think, kind of pre-Ayn Rand, there would be a distinction made between self-interest and selfishness, although Rand kind of conflated those two things. Yes. But, you know, there's I think this concern, you talk about justice, and, you know, I think there is this sort of concern, and I've heard this from kind of people on the new right who sort of said that, you know, well, you know, you free market fundamentalists are essentially arguing that selfishness, self-interest should motivate everything we do, and that, you know, we need to be more focused on the community, more focused on the collective. Now, the hidden thing that they don't tell you there is, well, that's why we need a strong man to manage that kind of thing. They're not saying you should, you know, voluntarily be less self-interested. They're saying somebody should make you less self-interested. But, you know, is it the case that self-interest is necessarily, you know, opposed to, you know, the flourishing of others? Or is it possible that someone can be interested in making a living and, you know, taking care of their family and making good investments, but also be a good neighbor? Are those two things necessarily contradictory?
Indeed not. I think, you know, your caricature is even worse than, things are actually worse than your caricature. Certainly, I think a lot of people, you know, they talk about the need for control and making people do the right thing and all of that kind of stuff. And then you think, well, who's going to be in control? And you can see in their minds, oh, it's going to be them, right? No, that's it. Cast your mind back to, I don't know, the Soviet revolution, Bolshevik revolution and so on, right? You know, who's going to be in charge? They were, right? So they would smash as many heads as necessary in order to make sure they were in charge. And it's exactly the same with academics these days, that they call for more government control because they think that they should be running the government. You know, they think they look at businesses and then, you know, some business people make a lot of money. And they think, well, I'm clever as well. I should be able to make that kind of salary. And of course they don't. They make academic salaries and they feel rather resentful about it. So there is, I think there's that kind of personal problem there. You know, what I would say is that Smith knew that unchecked greed harms society, but it harms individuals too. Look, my dad ran a filling station and repair shop, right? And he was widely liked in his village and further out because he was fair with people. He wasn't trying to make a quick buck. You can make a quick buck, but you can only make one quick buck, right? Because people won't come back to you. And they'll tell your friends that you're a swindler. And so, you know, you need to operate in a way, and this, well, you know, Rand would agree with this, it's in your long-term interest, you know, not just your short, greed is in short-term interest, but self-interest is in long-term interest. And so Smith distinguished prudent long-term self-interest from harmful excesses and greeds and so on. And I think the critics also ignore the theory of moral sentiments with its emphasis on sympathy and on conscience. And Smith knew that those were all part of the human psychology. I always say that, you know, we think of Smith as being an economist. We sometimes think of him being a philosopher. No, he was a social psychologist. He also wrote about arts and science and politics and language. He was exploring every part of the human mind. And he was saying, you know, we have so many different parts of the human mind that they all mesh together, but they're all slightly different, but they do coordinate. And so I think that critics often ignore the fact that markets do harness self-regard, self-interest, and produce, through the invisible hand, beneficial social outcome. It's not that there is a hand there, that there is a mind there that's doing this and forcing them to act in a certain way. It's the complex relationship between individual action and social outcomes. And as you say, I think critics are often ideologically opposed to individual action because they do want to plan society. And so they criticize Smith's faith in individuals because of that.
Yeah. Well, and you've talked a bit about Smith's ethics and, you know, one kind of objection you sort of hear is, okay, well, let's say we've just unleashed the markets. Everything is free now. Does that necessarily on its own create a better society, or is there actually a need for some kind of a social ethic or something that we sort of coalesce around that kind of helps us, you know, figure out? I mean, does markets determine everything, or is it there's just something more than that?
No, because as I say, you know, this is two different bits of the human mind. Lots of people, young people particularly, want to make lots of money and become millionaires, right? They don't all want to do that by selling drugs or selling arms or, you know, indulging in modern slavery, right? They want to do it in an honest way. What they want to do, and you can see this in successful business people, what they really want to do is to change people's lives, to produce products and services that people just love, right? I mean, you could see this in Steve Jobs and so on with Apple, you know, just producing beautiful machines that just change people's lives. Now you've got billions of smartphones on the planet. Every, you know, billions of people are connected. Now that is fantastic. And that's what most people want to do, right? There's a few bad guys who, you know, just want to make some money and do it in bad ways, or do it in ways that, bring them, as I say, a quick buck and then move off somewhere else. But really, for most people, these are the economics and the ethics are just two parts of the human mind, and our feelings of sympathy for others and justice ensure that our self-interest is controlled in a way that it serves the common good. And as I say, markets presuppose trust. You can't have a market unless you trust people, because you know you've got to obey contracts. And when you or I go into a coffee shop and order coffee, quite often we don't check the price because we know we're not going to be charged, you know, $50 for a cup of coffee, right? You know, we know that there are limits to these kinds of things, and that, so we trust people. And because we trust people, we don't have to write contracts for every purchase that we make or every good that we sell or whatever. We can just say, yeah, okay, if it doesn't work, bring it back. and then you do. So I think commerce brings personal responsibility. It also brings increasing wealth, of course, which you can use for education and for other forms of benevolence. You know, people who are richer give more to charity. Americans are much richer than we are here in the UK, and they give more to philanthropic causes. Of course they do, because they've got more money to do it. So the more that you can have a market that generates wealth, then the more you get that individual philanthropy and benevolence, and the more you get peace, because if people are trading together, either internationally or at home, well, they don't tend to fight so much, right? Because they've got a stake in it. You know, you want somebody else's products, they want your money. You know, both have an interest in keeping things peaceful. So without a moral framework, I think, yes, of course, capitalism amplifies certain vices and turns into cronyism and fraud and ultimately cultural delay, I suppose.
As you were talking about it, what occurred to me is there's kind of a reciprocal relationship between living an ethical life and a free market. Because if you have social trust, that makes it easier to have a free market. And then those free markets then make it less likely for us to go to war against our neighbors, less likely to steal from people that we're close to, less likely to use violence or force to get our way, because we know that there's other ways to do it that don't involve us having to go to prison. And so, yeah, I could see definitely a reciprocity there. I think that was perhaps what we were thinking when we said, you know, if we start trading with China and they liberalize their markets, they'll necessarily become a free people, which hasn't panned out as quite as what we hoped. But there's still time maybe to see what could happen there.
But it has happened for billions of other people. Yeah. You know, you look at India and so on, you know, a country of more than a billion people, opened up its markets in 1991, or started opening a little bit earlier than that, but really 1991 was the watershed, became part of the world trading system. And wow, you know, the caste system is nearly dissolved because brains are valued more than they used to be. So it doesn't matter what caste people come from. If they're good with IT, you want them, right?
Yeah.
And so you get things like that. And for most of my life, 4/5 of the human population or thereabouts has lived on dollar a day poverty. Now, after 30 years of globalization and a world trading system, dollar a day poverty does exist, but it just exists in a few pockets in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, we have virtually eliminated the most abject poverty from the planet. And we haven't done that by socialism. We had 70 years of socialism that didn't make any difference. We've done it by 30 years of trade and competition and markets and globalization. Now, that to me is just wonderful.
It is. Well, and that trend was already starting not long after the release of The Wealth of Nations. But as you're right, it's amplified significantly in those last 30 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But in any case, yeah, it's interesting to see what happens when you liberalize markets and start to limit government. So, you know, many libertarians would praise God for Smith, at least Christian libertarians, but they might differ with him on some points, such as his advocacy of the labor theory of value or public schools, public works. Are there, in your opinion, because I don't know which of those you object to. Are there any important areas where you personally think Smith got it wrong? The history has shown that he was on the money on some things, but, you know, of course, he was sort of original, and so he missed some other things.
Of course. I mean, he was a pioneer, and, you know, if you're a pioneer, you're going to get things wrong. And naturally, that's exactly what happened. But, I mean, on this thing about the labor theory of value, which is one of the criticisms that's made of Smith, and some people say, oh, he believed in the labor theory of value, which means that, in other words, something is worth the amount of effort, labor that is put into it, you see? And then that gave Marx ideas, and he said, oh, it's all about labor. And then he built an entire political philosophy on that, which, you know, is just horrible. So, yes, Smith did indeed mention labor. Now, everybody from, Aristotle, Plato even, onwards believed in a labor theory of value. They thought that something was worth the amount of effort that you put into it. It's obviously nonsense when you think about it, because if you dig a hole and you spend 6 months digging a hole, that doesn't make it valuable, right? It's a hole. It's not necessarily valuable, might be, but I doubt it. And so it's wrong. And Smith knew that there was something wrong with this theory. He talks of it only in a very limited way, where he's talking about what he calls the rude society. In other words, it's society without any capital or markets and things like that, really. And he talks about, well, if it takes twice as much effort to kill a deer as a beaver, then two beavers should exchange for one deer, or the other way around. I can never remember which it is. And you think, well, yeah, possibly. But Smith, I think it's clear from the rest of the book that he knew that this didn't square with how wages were determined. It didn't square with how prices were determined. It didn't square with profits or rent. It didn't tell you why water was cheap, certainly in Scotland, and diamonds were expensive when water was valuable. You know, you need it for life, and diamonds you can give or take. So he knew that there was something wrong with it, and he and his follower, David Ricardo, couldn't really work it out. Ricardo introduced lots of other things, like introducing capital and distributive factors and things like that. But that just made the theory even more complicated. And we had to wait until 1871, where Jevons in the UK and Karl Menger in Austria almost simultaneously published works on the marginal revolution, the marginal theory of value. And that's basically it. You know, diamonds are valuable because they're rare. People want them and they're rare. Water is extremely common in most places. Where it isn't, it's valuable. And where it is, like Scotland, then it isn't very valuable. So, you know, that's the labor theory thing. As for infrastructure and education and public works and all that kind of thing, yeah, he did. Yeah. He did this in the last book of Wealth of Nations, which I think is a bit rushed. And you can tell he's kind of rushing to finish it because all his chums, David Hume and all the others, were telling him, oh, for goodness sake, Smith, you've been working on this book for 15 years. You know, I mean, just, you know, get on with it. We're all waiting. So you can see him rushing to finish. So it's not altogether thought out. But he believed that if the market couldn't provide things like harbors and canals and bridges and roads, then the government had a duty to produce those things because they helped trade. And likewise, the government had some duty in education, you know, just partly to finance education, because that gave people the skills by which they could become effective players in the workplace, but also because where repetitive work eroded their minds, you know, then you could kind of restore their minds with education and things like dancing and you know, entertainment and such like that. So he believed that government should have some influence on all of that. But he knew that the bigger that governments were, the more of a magnet they were for people who would corrupt them. And the more corrupt officials there would be, with the more money to dispense and the more power to dispense it. So he certainly thought that we should have very limited government to defense and justice system and a very few public works. But as a pioneer, yes, of course, he got a few wrong things wrong, but the fundamentals he got right.
Well, it's I've sort of argued with people before who are kind of on the more authoritarian side of things for what I've called like a let's see anarchism. It's like, well, let's see what we can get rid of and have things still work. And if we absolutely need government to do public schools, or we absolutely need government to do roads or whatever, okay, that's fine. But otherwise, you were kind of getting at the end there is this idea that you know, government sort of has a responsibility to elevate the preferences, the tastes, the desires of the people, the knowledge of the people, so mm-hmm. that they are more inclined, or that the markets are more inclined to serve higher aspirations, something to that effect. Is that more or less correct?
Well, I wouldn't exactly say that. I think Smith took the view that commerce generates wealth that could be used in education. It could be used in, you know, as we see, foundation of orchestras and libraries and all sorts of things like that, which are more, I suppose, culturally beneficial. And that, you know, cultural values are another part of the human mind that we need to feed those cultural values. So it's not all about money. It's about how human beings live. And this is what Smith thought economics is all about. He says, it's not about production, it's about consumption, it's about how it affects ordinary individuals. So he thought that wealth would generate education, it would generate wealth for contemplation, we'd have more leisure to think about things, think about virtue and so on. He trusted individuals to strive to improve their lives and those of their families and communities. And he thought that markets expanded the opportunities for doing that and expanded the opportunities for what he called self-command, and in other words, responsibility, and for mutual benefit. So it's not that the market isn't serving the culture somehow and is reducing us all to the lowest common denominator. Smith says it's really quite the opposite. It gives you opportunities.
Gotcha. Well, so now, One criticism that I think comes up in different ways, you especially see it from folks on the new right. I think the man we call the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, probably gave one of the most explicit formulations of it. And it's this idea that prosperity, that leisure is sort of morally decadent and that it takes away our sense of meaning or purpose. And so sometimes you'll hear people who say, oh, you know, this idea of division of labor. Well, you know, somebody who's in a factory, you know, swinging a hammer all day long, or like, you know, or you ever see Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, where his job is to turn a, you know, a bolt, you know, over and over again. That you know, people are sort of, you know, Kaczynski's argument was like, you know, back like when we were, you know, hunter gatherers, our work had meaning. We were doing it for a reason that we could discern. And when you're in a factory, you know, turning a bolt, you know, yeah, you're doing it to make money, and, you know, yeah, you can pay your mortgage and, you know, buy food, but like, you have, I think he calls them like surrogate goals. You've developed these surrogate goals where you're no longer pursuing what you naturally desire to pursue, but you're doing something kind of artificial. And what I see is certain criticisms come up over and over again is that, you know, despite all the prosperity, despite all the leisure or whatever that's come out of this, to some extent, that prosperity has made us kind of divided us from a sense of meaning or purpose, and that we would be happier if we were back in abject poverty, so long as we were, you know, felt like life had some sort of higher meaning. I'm interested, just, you know, I don't know, you're more of an economist maybe than a philosopher, but I'd be interested kind of in your take on that. You're both, okay, very, very good. So what's your take on that kind of argument?
Well, you know, I think a lot of this comes from basically the experience of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, when it was established, they said socialism is going to be so much more efficient than your confused, chaotic, competitive, duplicative market system, that we're going to run rings around you. We're going to produce more benefits and more goods and services for the working public than you could ever dream of, you see. And then, of course, that didn't happen. In fact, exactly the opposite happened. And the Soviet Union lagged behind, and it was clearly lagging behind, despite the fact that it was very difficult to get information out of the Soviet Union behind the Berlin Wall. But nevertheless, it was clear that the Soviet bloc was in dismal poverty. And then the argument became, oh, well, the trouble with you people in the West is that you just worship materialism, that you're producing so much, and that is your new God. And of course, this is, you know, it was just designed to save a failing system. But it's true, of course, that in the industrial world, I mean, Smith's world, he saw and he wrote about this, which Marx would come up and say was alienation. If you're doing the same job over and over and over again, well, it just petrifies your mind, doesn't it? And therefore, that's one of the reasons why he said you need public spending on education, on you know, dancing and literature and reading and poetry and all of these things in order to restore the human mind. So we're not just dismal bolt turners like Charlie Chaplin. So he was very, very aware of that. I think, of course, as the economy develops, we actually have less and less repetitive work. We can get robots to do the repetitive stuff, and we can get on and do much more imaginative stuff. So I think that's great, and it's great for rich and poor alike, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and you know, the surrogate goals argument of Kaczynski's is interesting to me, because it seems to me most people I know who are, you know, 25 or under would love to be able to make their living sitting at home and playing, you know, Call of Duty, you know, shooting imaginary Germans. And it's like, well, that's a surrogate goal, isn't it?
Good point.
So as we're getting close to wrapping up the hour, and I want to be respectful of your time, maybe I'll ask one more kind of bigger question, and then we'll start kind of wrapping up. So the Wealth of Nations came out the same year of the Declaration of Independence. What is there a relationship between these documents? And do you think, this could be interesting, maybe you'd answer this differently as a Brit, which do you think is more important to freedom, to the ideas of freedom and liberty, the Declaration of Independence or the Wealth of Nations?
Wealth of Nations.
If you were an American, do you think you'd say the Declaration of Independence?
I probably wouldn't, but I'd be wrong. Okay. Yes, it's a very interesting question. Both documents, of course, are products of their time. They're products of an age of reason and enlightenment and of increasing individualism. And both assert the importance of independence and oppose, in America's case, national independence, but in Smith's case, individual independence, family independence, and they oppose controls on that independence. They share intellectual roots in the Enlightenment. John Locke, for example, is very profound in American thinking, certainly, and the Scottish moral philosophy of, you know, Hume and Hutcheson and all sorts of other folk like that, and Smith himself, of course. And later, those two documents actually reinforced each other, that the Americans, I think, when they everybody read The Wealth of Nations, right? I mean, I've seen a copy with Hamilton's signature on it, right? Everybody read it, and William Pitt's, yeah, I've seen one with his signature on too, right? Everybody read all the great politicians of the time. And I think the documents reinforced each other. Americans, I think, acquired more faith in individuals and markets. And I think that we, in Britain, Great Britain as it was, that we realized, as Smith said, of course, that, yes, actually, it is better if you let countries go their own way and you trade with them openly rather than try and force them to trade with you and nobody else. Yeah, actually, that's not the way to generate mutual prosperity. So, I would say that the Declaration is a kind of set of complaints and some ambitions, but the Wealth of Nations tells you how to get there.
Okay, interesting. So,
it's worth saying, by the way, that of course, yeah, that Smith was very much an advocate of the American cause, that he thought that the Americans had been terribly badly treated with all of the trade restrictions on them, yeah, and that those were damaging to both sides. So, but unfortunately, the Wealth of Nations, well, it came out in March, just before the Declaration, but so it didn't really, given the communications at the time, it didn't really affect it. But Smith, I think, had almost certainly talk to people like Franklin and so on, and others who would take his ideas, and that must have affected the American thinking. That, hey lads, not only are we right to oppose an oppressive government, but the ideas are on our side as well.
Right. Well, and yeah, so many of the complaints in the Declaration, I feel like, have gotten worse under our current system. But
I know the feeling. I think the same about Magna Carta myself.
Well, so 250th anniversary of Wealth of Nations, that's got to be an important time for the Adam Smith Institute, right? So what kind of stuff are you guys doing to mark that anniversary?
Oh, gosh, lots of people are doing things. I mean, there's conferences all over the place. And we've got a big lecture on Monday, which is the anniversary. I'm doing my cartoon Wealth of Nations book. And we've got another big book, academic book, on the Wealth of Nations and Adam Smith in general and his contribution to the world. So, yeah, there's a lot going on.
And when is that graphic novel going to be coming out?
I don't know exactly. It's about half done at the moment, and I think probably by June or July we'll have copies and have it. Half of it's online already at the Adam Smith Institute, adamsmith.org, but we should have printed copies in the summer.
And we'll be able to get those in the colonies as well.
Oh, I think so. Yes, such is international trade these days. Unless you raise tariffs against them, yes.
Well, and I noticed we talked about how long Wealth of Nations is. That you guys offer an abridged version, which I haven't been able to find like on Amazon, but I guess it could be ordered and shipped internationally, possibly.
Yeah, well, it's free online, so there's no reason why you should buy it. It's again, you go to adamsmith.org. Or just ask, Eamon Butler, Condensed Wealth of Nations, it's called, and you'll find it and you can download it.
Awesome. Now, one thing I can't download are those really cool Adam Smith ties that you guys sell, but I would like to get one of them.
Yeah, we'll really send you one. Don't worry.
Awesome. Well, so where can we find you? Where can we find the Adam Smith Institute, short of catching a flight to London?
adamsmith.org. Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
Okay. And is that primarily where you're working through, or do you have a social media or anything like that?
Yes. I mean, all the Adam Smith stuff will go on there. I mean, we have two organizations. One is a sort of company and the other is a charity, but they're all basically on the same website. So you can find your way around pretty easily, I think.
Awesome. Eamon, I want to thank you so much for your time. And it was nice of you to try to coordinate with us. I was trying to be respectful of the fact that in Europe, I know you guys don't like to work past working hours. So I...
Certainly not. We knock off at 5 o'clock.
All right. Well, have a good evening.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.